Welcome to the New World. Episode 14, The Mayans and Francisco Montejo. Last time, we gave a big sweep across the Spanish territories in the 1520s as various conquistadors received governorships for lands that they then went on to conquer. One of these I neglected to mention, not because I forgot or anything, but because reading about him made me think that it was finally time to get to a topic that I've been neglecting for far too long. You see, in 1527, Francisco Montejo was given the governorship of the Yucatan, which was occupied by the Mayans. Finally, we get to give the people of the Yucatan their time in the sun. Not only are the Mayans one of America's oldest and longest-lasting civilizations, they're one of the oldest in world history, going back to the days of the second millennium BC. As such, giving a comprehensive history of the Mayans is kind of an impossible task. Just as with the Chinese, Greeks, or Egyptians, it has to be split into different eras. Scholars tend to group Mayan history into three main periods: the pre-classic period, which more or less covers the first 2,000 years of Mayan civilization; the classic period, lasting about 1,000 years, which represents the height of Mayan culture and power; and the post-classic period, the gradual decline of Mayan civilization until the Spanish arrived in 1511. Let's not get ahead of ourselves, though, and set the stage. The Yucatan Peninsula. Mayan culture is intrinsically tied to the area from the Gulf of Mexico to the southern coast of Honduras along the Pacific Ocean. The environmental effects of the region directly contributed to the rise and fall of their civilization. So let's discuss the setting of our story. Though the area known as the Yucatan is dominated by jungles and forests, rainfall is very unreliable, and droughts are common. The landscape is not uniform, though, and a significant distinction can be made between the northern lowlands and the southern highlands. The highlands are the remnants of volcanoes, some still active. The rich volcanic soil allows large pine and oak trees to grow, while the locals harvest maize and squash and chili peppers of all kinds. The southern lowlands are hot, with only a few lakes and rivers, and basically no groundwater for wells. Most drinking water in the lowlands can be found in cenotes, large vertical sinkholes that often connect to other underground caverns. The rest of the land is made up of large forests and the occasional savanna. In the jungles lurked monkeys, snakes, jaguars, and birds of bright colors. It was in this environment that the Mayans made, and still make, their home. The Mayans claimed that the gods created humanity from maize dough after several failed attempts with wood and mud. The pre-classic period is where the Mayan political and cultural institutions emerged after the discovery of reliable agriculture. Like ancient Greece, or more similarly, those just to the west in Mexico, Mayan civilization took the form of a great many separate city-states, competing with one another for power and resources. From the island of Cozumel in the Caribbean Sea to the Pacific coast of Honduras, they built villages, then towns, then great cities with monuments and public places. Among the ruins that archaeologists have found, things that many other developing civilizations of the area had can be seen, such as unique clay pottery. However, already we can see things that separate the Mayans from other contemporary civilizations, like the Persians or Chinese. One of these was a ball court, wherein the Mayans played a sport known as simply as the Mayan ball game. In this game, a rubber ball was passed back and forth between two teams on a court using the right hip, right elbow, or right knee, and the goal was to force the enemy to have the ball touch the ground on their side. Ball games also held religious significance as well, as many games hosted religious sacrifices. Just like the Aztecs, the Mayans practiced human sacrifice to show the ultimate devotion to their gods. The year 200 AD, the same century as the decline of the Roman Empire and the ending of the Chinese Han Dynasty, is generally thought of as the beginning of the Classic Period, the height of Mayan civilization. Cities choked with tens of thousands of people, markets filled with goods from across the Mesoamerican world. Kings constructed massive palaces and temples, pyramids of stone decorated with painted frescoes and sculpted statuaries. The city of El Mirador, for example, had even by the early pre-classic period constructed a temple pyramid some 230 feet in height. For example, the Statue of Liberty is only about 150. Mayan writing and astronomy flourished, and not one but two different calendar systems were created to predict celestial events and aid in planting and harvesting. These are known to us as the calendar round and the long count. Now, these are pretty complicated, so I won't go too far into it, but be aware that Mayan timekeeping was quite sophisticated, but did not predict the end of the world in 2012. The classic period was also where Mayan kingship grew, not just in importance, but in grandiosity. Another hallmark of the Mayan culture introduced in the classic period was the stelae. These were tall stone monuments raised by kings to record their deeds. Though these were only common for about 1,500 years, there were a great many Mayan kings throughout that period. When the Spanish landed in the Yucatan, they found stelae dotting the whole landscape, and you can still find many today. A powerful king raised stelae throughout his land, and surrounded himself with a court full of hundreds of warriors, priests, and intellectuals of all kinds. At that same time, the city of Teotihuacan was laying the cultural and political groundwork that the Aztecs would inherit. Their eastern neighbors, the Mayans, were a consistent and valuable trade partner. There were dozens of great cities during this period. Palenque, Tikal, Dos Pilas, Copan, Calakmul, and Cayal, just to name a few. However, the good times can only last for so long. You might initially think that the Mayans just slowly stagnated in power, or were conquered by an outside force. Instead, things were much more apocalyptic. The Mayan classic period concluded with a massive collapse of urban life, intellectual development, and political structure. Entire cities were either destroyed or simply abandoned, their populations displaced and buildings left empty. Knowledge of things such as astronomy and poetry became rare. You might be asking yourself, how did this happen? Well, with all the research and archaeology available to modern historians, the official answer is still, we don't know. There isn't any one response that entirely explains things. After all, civilizations and empires rarely fall for one simple reason. However, the one that best lines up with authors that I've read is ecological devastation. The Mayan heartland, right in the middle of the Yucatan, was overpopulated by the year 1000. With this overpopulation came a strain on resources, more than local farmland could support. All it would take was one serious drought to bring about environmental collapse. When this drought came, water reserves were depleted, and things quickly got worse. Environmental collapse led to a population collapse, as starving citizens left for literally greener pastures. Then a political collapse occurred, as kings found their armies low on manpower and their coffers empty. By the year 1000, the most powerful Mayan cities were relegated to the coasts of the far north and south, and not the mountainous interior. Charles Mann claims that the population of some southern areas was reduced by 3/4, a massive change that would not be repeated until the arrival of European plagues centuries later. This catastrophe was the beginning of the Mayan post-classic period, lasting from the turn of the millennium onward. Though the Mayans had fallen far, unable to field the large armies or build the massive temple complexes of old, they certainly weren't gone. New cities rose to power and established trade networks just as they did before. Take, for example, the famous cities of Chichen Itza or Mayapan, which were both regional hegemons up until their abandonment of their cities by the mid-15th century. The Mayans continued to trade with their neighbors, including the arriving Nahuatl peoples to the west and peoples along the Central American coast. In various towns and city-states, Mayan people visited the marketplaces, performed sacrifices, and played ball. But the cycles of war, disease, starvation, and the abandonment of cities continued. So by the early 16th century, the Mayans were centuries removed from the splendor they had once possessed, but they were still very much around. It was here, though, that the Spanish entered the scene. The first major interaction between the Mayans and the Spanish was, of course, the meeting of Christopher Columbus and Mayan traders on his final voyage in 1502. You might recall that one from episode 5. And while Columbus found the wealth and variety of Mayan goods very interesting, he chose to head south to Central America rather than north to Yucatan. 9 years later, a Spanish caravel was shipwrecked off the Yucatan coast. The survivors were captured by the local Mayan lord, who may or may not have sacrificed most of them. The only two survivors we know of are two men we've already met before, Jeronimo de Aguilar, who would be picked up by Cortes in 1519, and Gonzalo Guerrero, who stayed behind. Next came Hernandez de Cordoba, who arrived from Cuba on a slave-taking expedition not long afterwards. But he soon bailed out after a Mayan army greeted him at Champoton and 25 Spaniards were killed. Then, of course, there was Grijalva, who brought tales of gold back to Cuba, and Hernan Cortes, who followed up on those tales. He found Aguilar and Malinche as interpreters, and the sight of the Mayan pyramids led him to name the land Gran Cairo, obviously after Egypt. However, while the land of the Maya may have been visually appealing, the material wealth must not have been enough for Cortes, because soon enough he had set sail to the west. Finally, there were the Alvarado brothers, who conquered the far southern group of Mayans, the Cachiquels and Quiches in Guatemala. Of course, during this time, the Mayans fell victim to the same smallpox epidemic that crippled the Aztecs, and there's no doubt they suffered just as much. As I mentioned in the last episode, many conquistadors were inspired by the success of Hernan Cortes to conquer territories of their own. One of these men happened to be Francisco Montejo, a man of between 40 and 50 years of age, who had been in America for over a decade. He had seen action in Mexico, Cuba, and Panama, and had met just about every major Spanish figure in all of those places. As a result, he'd gained himself some encomiendas in New Spain. After talking to the previously shipwrecked Jeronimo de Aguilar, he learned all about the wealth of the Yucatan and the various goods produced by the people who lived there. He learned how the Mayans used their land to grow maize and cotton, but also cacaos, papayas, and avocados. He learned how they drank pulque, made from fermented agaves, and grew cacao deep in their well-watered cenotes. He learned about their well-crafted jade ornaments and fancy headdresses, and how they produced more salt than most nations in Europe. He learned of all this, and decided it would be his for the taking. The reason why the Yucatan hadn't been conquered up until now was simple. It wasn't seen as worth it. Conquistadors were businessmen as much as they were soldiers, and they wanted the easiest possible profit. Up until now, that had meant chasing gold, which the Mayans didn't have in large supply. Therefore, the real value of the Yucatan to Montejo would be in its land and agricultural output. Or so he thought. After all, Montejo didn't know the Mayans' long history of drought and famine. In December of 1526, he convinced the Council of the Indies of the benefits of Yucatan's potential, not as a gold mine, but as a breadbasket. The emperor handed him down a promotion as governor and a captain general of his new province. And within a few months, he had set off for the Yucatan with 250 veteran conquistadors in tow. The Spanish landed just off the coast of Cozumel, around what is today Playa del Carmen. After a few weeks of converting the Mayan city of Xel-Há into a settlement called Salamanca de Xel-Há, they began to run out of food from their ships. They then decided to rob the locals for food, but with other supplies running short, mass desertion was proving to be a real possibility. After all, the same had happened to Francisco de Garay a few years ago. Therefore, Montejo burned his own ships, in imitation of Cortes. With his men having nowhere to flee, the only way they were getting off the Yucatan was in victory. In the short term, victory meant establishing a better capital, one with a good harbor and the resources for him to continue his campaign, which he found in the northeastern port town of Conil. Conquering the Mayans proved far different from conquering the Aztecs. They had no capital to seize, no emperor to imprison. They'd been fighting city to city against one another for over 1,000 years, and so conquering them would mean subduing every last one. They didn't have long to wait before this fighting began. In 1528, the Spanish entered the city of Aque. Upon their arrival, the Mayans abandoned the city, then surrounded and assaulted it. The Spanish came face to face with the Mayan Holcanob, soldiers armed with armor made from tapir hide and cotton. They carried flint spears, javelins, and bows, as they had for generations. Their bows in particular shot arrows with tips made from obsidian and were particularly deadly. However, on the open battlefield, the horsemen, cannons, and handguns of the Spanish won the day with minimal losses. The Spanish were still few in number, though, and needed to maintain their strength in order to not be totally wiped out in one battle. Over the course of several skirmishes and just general attrition, Montejo's original force of 250 men was whittled down to only 60, and he was forced to return to his original landing site. As they went, they likely saw many ruins of abandoned Mayan cities from long ago. A resupply ship from Santo Domingo had arrived, but Montejo was determined to continue rather than cut his losses. He decided to explore to the south, sending one group by land and one by sea, and reached the port city of Chetumal on the southern end of the Yucatan Peninsula. In Chetumal, Montejo and his men saw many interesting sights. There were farms of beekeepers, plenty of cacao farming, and one Spaniard who was equally surprised to find them. This was the shipwrecked Gonzalo Guerrero, whose comrade Jerónimo de Aguilar had been picked up by Cortés years ago. Guerrero had stayed behind, having grown affectionate of the Mayan people, with several Mayan children. He was currently serving as a military advisor to Chetumal's king, and it had been 8 years since he had seen a European face. Montejo sent Guerrero a letter, imploring him to join up with his expedition. Since Hugh Thomas records it in full, I'll read it to you now. "Gonzalo, my special friend and brother, I count it as your great good fortune that I have arrived, and I have learned of you through the bearer of this letter. I remind you that you are a Christian, created by the blood of Christ, our Redeemer, to whom you should give infinite thanks. You have a great opportunity to serve God and the Emperor in the pacification and baptism of these people, and more than that, to leave your sins behind you with the grace of God, and so benefit and honor yourself. I shall be your good friend in this, and you will be treated very well. Thus, I beseech you not to let the devil influence you to decline what I have said. On my part, and as a gentleman, I give you my word and pledge my faith to make my promises to you without any reservation whatsoever. And I shall make you one of my principal men, and one of the most dearly loved and select of these parts. Consequently, I beg you to come to this ship or the coast without delay to do what I have suggested, and help me carry out this work of conversion by giving me your wisest advice and opinions." End quote. Guerrero read this letter, considered it carefully, and wrote this on the back of the very same paper. "Señor, I kiss your lordship's hand. As I am a slave, I have no freedom. I have a wife and children, even though I remember God. You, my lord, and the Spaniards will find me a very good friend." End quote. Despite his seeming amicability, Guerrero had no intention of letting his new home fall under Spanish control. He knew that Montejo had sent a second group to Chetumal by land, and sent word to its leader, Alonso de Avila, that Montejo was dead. He also told Montejo that Alonso de Avila was dead. The two then abandoned their mission, with Avila returning to Salamanca de Xelha, and Montejo sailing further south to Honduras. I can only imagine that the Mayanized Guerrero was quite pleased with this successful deception, though Montejo and Avila would both reunite upon their returns to Xelha and realize that they had been duped. Montejo was still very low on manpower, and so he and his entire company packed up and set off for New Spain. After all, Montejo was a veteran of the Aztec conquests, and he had several wealthy encomiendas in Mexico with which to replenish his funds and his men, among whom was his son, also named Francisco. At the time, New Spain was in the period of uncertainty between the rule of Cortes and the establishment of the viceroyalty. The leader at the time was Nuño de Guzmán, head of the Audiencia. Guzmán learned of Montejo's arrival and offered to help, so long as Montejo restarted his Yucatan conquest from the west rather than the east. Montejo agreed and started out in 1530 by conquering Tabasco in the far southern bend of the Gulf Coast. From here, he made his way north to his new base of operations, the Mayan city of Champeche, which, in addition to being a port, also happened to be the center of a well-populated area. Here, Montejo and his men read the requerimiento to the local Mayan kings, as they often did, and declared it to be his new base of operations. The next few years would prove to be a frustrating series of battles over the future of the Yucatan Peninsula. The Spanish would return to Chetumal and attempt to found their own city of Villarreal, but conflicts with the Mayans, perhaps still being advised by Guerrero, defeated them and forced them to flee to Honduras in canoes. They also attempted the same in the city of Chichen Itza, renaming it Ciudad Real. However, upon reading the requerimiento there, the Mayans reportedly responded by saying, "We already have kings. We are the Itza." Though the Spanish did find friends in the Xiu Mayans, even those who submitted to Spanish control only usually did so temporarily. Several rebellions were launched, under charismatic Mayan leaders like Mancanahual and Nacon Capul, forcing the small numbers of Spanish into battles they couldn't afford to fight. On more than one occasion, Montejo and his son were nearly killed. Of the few conquistadors remaining, many who weren't killed were instead drawn away by the discovery of a much richer land in Peru. On top of all this, Montejo was finally convinced of what the Mayans had known for many centuries, that the Yucatan made a poor place to grow crops. Allow me to read you his letter to the emperor. "There is not a single river, though there are lakes. The entire land is covered by a thick bush and is so stony that there is not a single foot of soil. No gold has been discovered, nor is there anything else from which advantage can be gained. The people are the most abandoned and treacherous in all the lands discovered until this time, and being people who have never yet killed a Christian except by foul means. With the news from Peru, the soldiers will not remain here any longer." End quote. So, no sources of gold have been found, no land was suitable for the agriculture Montejo envisioned, and the few Mayans who did submit to the Spanish often rebelled soon after. With few men and little left to gain, Montejo gave in. He abandoned Champeche in 1534, taking his son and his dreams of a Yucatan province with him. It would not be until the 1540s that the Spanish would return to Champeche under Montejo's son, Montejo himself having gone to the Alvarados in Guatemala. With hundreds more conquistadors, Montejo the Younger was able to found the city of Mérida in the northwest, a city that is still the capital of the Yucatan province today. The northwest coast would be the extent of Spanish control in the Yucatan for several more decades to come. That's where I'll leave things for now. The Mayans had weathered many centuries of struggle, but so far, they had weathered the storm of Spanish conquest fairly well. In so doing, they had achieved what the Tainos in the Caribbean and the Aztecs in Mexico could not, defeating a determined force of Spanish conquistadors. You could claim that they survived because the Spanish weren't interested enough in conquering the Yucatan, or that they were better prepared because they'd already encountered the Spanish before with the help of Gonzalo Guerrero. But the fact of the matter is that even after 10 years of fighting, many Mayan city-states stood firm, and they would stand firm for over 100 years to come. One of my sources, The Maya by Michael D. Coe and Stephen Houston, quotes a poem from a Mayan book, the Chilam Balam, that I found particularly fitting. "Eat, eat, thou hast bread. Drink, drink, thou hast water. On that day, dust possesses the earth. On that day, a blight is on the face of the earth. On that day, a cloud rises. On that day, a mountain rises. On that day, a strong man seizes the land. On that day, things fall to ruin. On that day, the tender leaf is destroyed. On that day, the dying eyes are closed. On that day, three signs are on a tree. On that day, three generations hang there. On that day, the battle flag is raised, and they are scattered afar in the forests. On that day, the battle flag is raised, and they are scattered afar in the forests. End quote. If you or someone you know have visited some Mayan ruins, why not email us at historyofthenewworld@gmail.com? Also, give us a review on whatever platform you're listening. It really helps spread our message further. Recommend us to your friends, if you want. Next time, we're going to take a trip south to Peru, where so many of Montejo's men had journeyed. It turns out that Francisco Pizarro was right about there being a wealthy empire down there. But it was an empire in chaos, one he was primed to take advantage of. I'll see you then.